Okay, we're starting here, correct? So, in terms of hematologic diseases or blood diseases, we did get through anemias, we did get through hemochromatosis. So, remember, hemochromatosis, too much iron, anemias, not as much, or therefore low ability to carry oxygen. And then, of course, now the leukemias are, and I just to remind you, that basically leukemia is considered to be that normal blood-forming cells are replaced with a malignant clone cell, or doesn't look like a normal cell, of a lymphocyte or myelogenous sort of origin. When we look here, we've got two types of cells. A lymphoid stem cell directly becomes a lymphocyte, whereas a myeloid cell can go in a number of different directions to either a myeloblast or a pronorm oblast. It works all the way down to erythrocyte, of course, would be a red blood cell. A myeloid stem cell can also become a megakaryocyte, which can result in the creation of platelets. And then we get this, again, direct myeloid to a monocyte, and then can become last of the myoblast to a promyelocyte, and then it can work all its way through. All of these basically are white blood cells, considered white blood cells. Of course, here we have a red blood cell, we have a white blood cell here, and remember, platelets are formed by this massive megakaryocyte that then breaks into all these little tiny pieces. So what we're saying here is that malignant neoplasm of blood forming cells that replaces normal bone marrow with a malignant clone of either lymphocyte origin, lymphocytic origin, or myelogenous cells or myelogenous origin. Leukemia can be acute or chronic, and it is classified according to its morphology. So what type of cell is involved in this leukemia, and what's the level of maturity of that cell? Lympho is for leukemias involving lymphoid or lymphatic system, and myelo for leukemias of myeloid or bone marrow origin involving the hematopoietic stem cells. Of course, remember that blastic for large immature functionless cells and cytic when they become mature functional cells. So blastic when they're not quite yet mature enough to do their thing, whereas when we're looking at cytic, of course, it represents a functional cell. So acute represents rapidly progressive malignant disease with an accumulation of blast cells in bone marrow and blood that block the development of normal cell development. So this is when we look under the microscope at blood, and we see very, very many immature blast cells in the marrow or in the blood, depending on where they look. And there's so many of them, it blocks the normal maturation of blastic cells to become cytic or functional cells. So we have acute myeloid leukemia. Again, let's go back here, remembering it's all about the origin. Is it lymphatic in nature through a lymphoid stem cell, or is it out of bone as a myeloid stem cell? So acute myeloid leukemia, uncommon, but and when we look at it, it is considered to be the most common in adults if adults get leukemia at later age. More common in men than women, and incidences of this acute myeloid leukemia increases with each decade of life. So it's the older you get, again, you're getting this potential for this occurring. It is a heterogeneous group, not all the same, of neoplastic myeloid cells. So the myeloid cells that were starting out that are going to head in the many directions of the many cells that the myeloid origin can go, is that we're saying that you get neoplastic changes that can occur along any of those lines. So granulocytes, monocytes, erythrocytes, and platelets can all be in the blastic state, not the mature state when we see it. So when you look under a microscope, you would see many, many immature versions of these cells, and they're not given the opportunity to mature because there's too many immature ones. Initial indications show pancytopenia, which is a reduction in all cell lines as a result of these leukemic cell replacement of bone marrow. So over time, you'll start to see that all the cells that are created in the myeloid line all start to diminish. We see less and less of them, quite simply because, you know, you get the leukemic cell starting to take over the space where the bone marrow is, and there's an inability to actually create these particular cells along this line. Often increase in infections or bleeding secondary to lack of platelets, because remember, megakaryocyte is from the myeloid origin, and therefore you wouldn't have platelets to be able to clot in the first place. Spontaneous bleeding can occur with minor trauma. So gingival bleeding, of course, your gums are the gingiva. Epistaxis, do you remember what epistaxis is? Nosebleed, right? Seems an odd name for a nosebleed, doesn't it? It really does. Mid-cycle menstrual bleeding and petechia. Now, what is petechia? Yeah, so do you ever notice that occasionally you get little red spots in your skin just come out of nowhere? So what they'll actually get is you'll see in these folks an accumulation, my understanding is, an accumulation enough that you may look and think it's a bruise because it accumulates, right? So these folks get come to the doctor and say, I don't know what's going on. I'm getting all these red little tiny bruises all over my body, and I don't know why. Would you say that's fairly quite often the first reason why someone goes to the physician because they notice all these? Yeah. All kinds of them, yeah. It's also, petechia is also associated to certain types of asphyxiation, that kind of stuff. The pathologist will kind of look and see petechia in that case. If it gets significant enough, of course, if we've got leukemic cells, blastic cells sort of taking over the red marrow, in of course, as we know, within bones, then you'll start to see pain in those areas where we find red marrow, ribs, sternum, and tibia, because you get this expanding leukemic marrow. Quite literally what's happening is when we look at the marrow within the space between the cortical pieces, it's expanding so much it's actually pushing on the sides of the bone, and the patient feels it as very, very uncomfortable. Commonly treated with chemotherapy, and if untreated, all leukemias are fatal. Would it be fair to say, Sunil, that they will use bone marrow transplant to try to alter this condition?
Yes.
Yep.
And then
kill all
the marrow and then
put new one in, yeah. Very risky.
Yes.
Acute lymphoblastic leukemia or acute lymphocytic leukemia. It is more frequent and in children, the median age is 15. So quite often when you hear of a child getting leukemia, this is the most common type that a child gets. Characterized by inability of the lymphocytic progenitor cells, lymphoblasts, to mature into B cells and T cells. So what role do B cells and T cells play? Sorry? Yeah, immunity. So these children eventually get terrible, terrible infections if it's not treated appropriately. Commonly present with hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, fever, in the mediastinal, lymphadenopathies, and sometimes you can actually get a mass within here if the child has it, abnormal blood counts and musculoskeletal pain. And quite often it's a musculoskeletal pain that usually brings them into the doctor in the first place. They tend to have these pains, and they've likely seen a physio or a massage therapist or whatever, and it just doesn't seem to get rid of it, and they don't understand why. And, of course, then they would do some blood work, and you'd start to see some of this stuff. The result of all of this is the result of a bone marrow that is unable to have normal hepatopoiesis. So it's unable to create new cells. Fever can be due to infections associated to the lack of B cells and T cells or the leukemia itself. These folks bleed easily and bruise easily. You can get central nervous system involvement, headaches, weakness, seizures, vomiting, difficulty with balance, radiculopathies, cranial nerve palsies, and blurred visions. Testicles in males and ovaries in females can harbor leukemic cells and difficult to reach with chemotherapy. So this is why sometimes if it gets into those sorts of centers, the child has a hard time reaching a great outcome with chemotherapy. Initially aggressive chemotherapy and then consolidation and then maintenance usually. Now what's nice about it is 98% of children and 85% of adults achieve complete remission of the cancer. But the one thing they don't tell you quite often is that the treatments to rid the individual of this cancer tends to do damage to certain other areas of the body that when they reach adulthood, they have significant other health issues as a result of this. I think I told you guys, I went to Gilda's house one time to do a talk, And the vast majority of people who were there that night were parents of children who had acute lymphoblastic a leukemia. It's quite common. You see it quite often. So these are your two acutes, acute myeloid and acute lymphoblastic. Then is your chronic leukemias. So it progresses much slower and permits numbers of more mature functional cells to be made. So, you know, it hangs around, but they're not, these other cells along these myeloid or lymphatic lines, they will still be somewhat produced when you're looking at a chronic leukemia. There are two major groups. There's chronic myeloid leukemia and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So let's do myeloid first. It is a neoplasm of the hematopoietic stem cells that are committed to the myeloid lineage. So meaning that, you know, again, going back here, I know I keep going back here, but when you're talking about the myeloid origin, then now you're seeing that many, many aspects of functional cells, once they reach mature state in blood, can be affected. It accounts for 15% of all leukemias with a median age of about 65. It causes overproduction of myeloid cells. When people are in the chronic phase, the majority are about 85%, and signs and symptoms are often very nonspecific. In 50% of individuals who have chronic myeloid leukemia, we get splenomegaly, which is what? Sorry? Of the spleen, correct. And a significant enlargement of the spleen. Overall, 5-year survival rate is about 68%, but is improving with new treatments. Now, the chronic lymphocytic form is the most common type of leukemia in adults. Median age of presentation is about 50, men more affected than women. The cell type most responsible for 95% of the cases is B cell. B cells are made where? Remember what B stands for? Yeah, bone marrow. That's how I always remembered it. B cells are created in marrow. T cells are also created in marrow, but they get matured in the thymus, and hence why they're called T cells. Always remember, B cells come directly out of bone marrow. T cells come out of the thymus. That's why I always remembered them. It's probably why they're called B and T cells, right? Probably in the first place. B cells are stimulated by antigens and then proliferate, creating clones to fight infection. So during that proliferative phase, the cell can create many mutations, possibly some of them which go on to eventually become cancerous. Early stages of this tend to sort of represent as fatigue or enlarged lymph nodes, but more often than not, they're asymptomatic. They don't really notice anything. Lymphadenopathies are the most common sign, and splenomegaly also common. So in both, whether it's myeloid or lymphocytic, it's you know, enlarged spleen is not uncommon, and then, of course, lymph nodes all around the body getting very enlarged and hard. Malignant lymphocytes can invade the skin, called leukemia cutis. It results in macules, papules, plaques, nodules, or exfoliative erythroderma in the head and neck area. It is fatal with a significant impact on life expectancy. The 5-year survival rate is 84%. What is 5-year survival rate? After 5 years. So only 84% of those, it's high, but it's not good. So that means that, you know, 16% of people who get this don't even make 5 years. Okay, lymphoma. Anybody here had anybody with lymphoma? It's quite common. A lot more. Yes, you know someone, yes. So general term for cancers that develop in the lymphatic system. There are two groups. There is Hodgkin lymphoma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. It's currently classified according to clinical behavior. It can be indolent, which means it's very slow, or aggressive, which is fast. So, you know, quite often we hear in the news that someone had Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's, and everybody thinks, well, everything could be fine. But you can have aggressive forms versus very slow forms. So you also have to consider that as well when looking at it. So we can see here a normal lymph node. And what happens in this condition? It can get significantly enlarged and quite affected. So Hodgkin, lymphoid neoplasms with the histological finding of giant Reed-Sternberg cells in lymph nodes. I'm not too concerned that you know that exact name, but it's not a bad idea to remember if you come across it. My whole thing is understanding you get very large cells in the lymph node itself. These cells are of the B cell lineage and they have two nuclei and nucleoli. Hence, they're known as owl eye cells because they have the two. I think you have a picture of it. Because they have the two, they actually look like a pair of owl eyes within the cell under the microscope. Primarily involves lymph nodes, but can spread to spleen, liver, and bone marrow. Two groups, there's classic Hodgkin lymphoma, which further is divided into four categories, or nodular lymphocyte predominant NLPHL, which is uncommon. It can occur in both children and adults, but peaks at two different ages, 20 and 65. So you see a peak age at 20 years, and then you don't see it again until someone's around 65. Previous infection with Epstein-Barr virus. It's interesting, you know, when I was doing all the research in this book to try to get these lectures and that, this little bugger is everywhere and seems to cause all kinds of problems in the human body when you go back to seeing where it is. So an Epstein-Barr, of course, is mosquitoes can carry it. There's a number of places you can get it. So it intrigued me that so many people with conditions have this possibly as an origin. So previous infection with Epstein-Barr, along with those with HIV or immunosuppression. So if they're on immunosuppressant drugs for other reasons, it does increase the possibility of Hodgkin lymphoma. The cell of classic Hodgkin's is the Reed-Sternberg cell, which is a clonal lymphoid cell of the B lineage. Other cells that can be associated are mummified cells, so cells that have a condensed cytoplasm, lacunar cells, Hodgkin cells, abnormal B cells, and popcorn cells, which the nucleus is very kind of folded and looks like a, you know, popcorn has all those irregular kind of whatever. So the nucleus actually looks like a piece of, like a thing of popcorn. You usually get a lot of inflammatory cells around these. HL and NLPHL present differently and progress differently. Classic HL begins in a lymph node and spreads to other lymph nodes such as cervical, supraclavicular, mediastinal are the most common. The nodes are typically non-tender but firm. So they're not sore, but they're quite firm. Below the diaphragm, with B symptoms, fever, night sweats, and weight loss will likely develop splenomegaly. So lymph nodes can become large enough to the tracheal or bronchi in the abdomen that can result in obstructions. So you can actually get something that will actually push against the trachea, hard to breathe, or push against organs such as the small intestine and actually end up with a bowel blockage of some kind because it's so enlarged. Node can continue to grow with perforation of the node capsule and invasion into the surrounding tissues, lung, pericardium, pleura, chest wall, gut, or bone. And effusions can develop in the lung, heart, or abdominal cavity, so that, of course, collection of fluids can spread through the blood and go to the lung, liver, bone marrow. And when it gets out to this area, you're extensively into the disease, and outcome is not great. Pregnancy, with a mean age at 39, it is not uncommon for women to develop when pregnant. What's interesting, according to the book, is it's not a death sentence to have it when you're pregnant, both for the fetus and for mom. The treatments seem to be okay, and both tend to survive. It's diagnosed through an incisional biopsy of involved tissue. I mean, I've seen people in oncology when I had to go in, and their necks were, until treated, were very, very, very enlarged. It almost looked like they had a goiter, and it was all the lymph nodes. So think of mumps times 10, right? It gets quite involved. It's staged 1 through 4. It is a highly curable disease that's treated with chemotherapy, no matter what stage it's in. If the disease is localized, it's more favorable and it can include radiation. Survivors at high risk for developing a secondary malignancy, even as long as 40 years after they've been diagnosed. So if you're diagnosed at 20 or so, you could still possibly have a higher possibility of developing a secondary malignancy. It's considered one of the most curable forms of cancer. Prognosis depends on staging and the presence of risk factors. And we probably know some people who've had it, you know, famous people. What's his name? Who used to play for Pittsburgh Penguins hockey? He had it. What was his name? He was a big superstar. He was Frenchman. Anyways, Lots of people you'll see it comes across. Then there's non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Now, this comprises a large group of lymphoid malignancies that present as solid tumors arising from cells from the lymphatic system. There are 30 specific types. Thank God we don't need to know them. Physicians need to know them, but we don't need to know them. And they're all based on the cell that involves into it. Yeah, yeah. 98% occur in adults, 2% in children. Basically, lymph nodes usually involve first, and bone marrow is then infiltrated by the lymphoma cells, but rarely is bone marrow the primary site of it. It tends to be in lymph nodes. Most common is large B-cell lymphoma, which is an aggressive, fast-growing tumor. Second most common is called follicular lymphoma, which is indolent, which means slow-growing, that responds to treatment but often relapses. And a wide variety of autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, and immunodeficiency disorders increase the incidence. So, again, you know, we were talking about connective tissue disorders, and we were talking about SLE. And when you leave SLE alone and you look at it directly, you know, you speak to it and how it affects whatever. There are many other associated diseases that increase the possibility when you have this type of disease going on. Rheumatoid arthritis, again, and again, even with rheumatoid arthritis, a lot of people think, oh, just take some pills, the joints get better and you're good to go. But there's so many other systems that can get involved. My friend, his wife's had RA for, well, I think, 20, 25 years of her life now, and she's now getting cardiac and lung involvement because it's just slowly progressing to that part. So, yeah. And so they've treated her, you know, her all the things that can happen with the joints, and that's all done very well, but now she's on puffers and all sorts of things because of it. HIV, the risk factor is higher, along with hepatitis C. So anything like this will result in it. So malignant lymphomas can develop from the accumulation of genetic mutations, which affects the proto-oncogenes or tumor suppressor genes. Remember that when I talked about oncology initially? Right, these tumor suppressor genes, if they get sort of semi-shut down, then the mutations to cancer go up to tumors. This is variable in presentation and course from indolent to rapidly progressing. The most common finding is lymphadenopathies. 50% develop extranodal disease. Other symptoms, fatigue, pruritus, hypersensitivity to insect bites and effusions. Some presentations can include spinal cord compression, pericardial tamponade, and so forth. And this has to do with, you know, lymph nodes that are excessively growing and getting larger and pushing on structures because they're getting so large. The indolent forms, the slow-growing forms, can be asymptomatic for years, even after diagnosis. Aggressive form mostly display rapid, progressive lymphadenopathy. Accurate diagnosis is important as other pathologies can mimic, such as infections, tuberculosis, lupus, lung and bone cancers. Bone marrow is always examined for staging, and the five-year survival rate for non-Hodgkin lymphoma is only 70%. Multiple myeloma. So again, we're into that myeloid lineage here. The primary malignant neoplasm of plasma cells in bone marrow, immune cell that makes large amounts of a specific antibody. So that's what this represents. Initially affects the bone and bone marrow of vertebra, ribs, skull, pelvis, and femur. It then goes on to progressively damage the kidneys and recurrent infections and damages bone and nerves. You can get several other disorders and malignancies that develop from the proliferation of these monoclonal plasma cells. Right? Because remember, we're talking about this myeloid lineage. 6.9 cases per 100,000 between men and women both. So it's not that common. It's the second most common cause of hematologic cancers and can develop at any age, with black men more affected than white and men more than women. It's caused by a pre-malignant plasma cell as a result of multiple genetic abnormalities and microenvironmental changes that lead to the transformation of plasma cells to cancer cells. So again, it's within, you know, you don't realize that within this bone marrow, you're constantly producing, right? So anything that's, you know, has such a high turnover rate always has a higher probability of mutation cells that take over and take place. B-cell lineage that have undergone terminal differentiation, basically, is what this is. So we can see here we've got normal plasma cells here with antibodies, and we can see multiple myeloid cells. They're enlarged, they're big, they start to fill in, and they squeeze out everything else, and nothing else much can happen. There's an imbalance in function of bone cells, so there's an imbalance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts, which results in lytic bone lesions, so you start getting holes in the bone, basically is what ends up happening. Categorized as either asymptomatic or symptomatic. Have you ever heard the term smoldering? I'd never seen that term before. Yeah. Yeah, just non-stop. Doesn't do this, just does that. Onset is gradual and insidious. Common features, so signs, symptoms, fatigue, bone pain, neurological symptoms, renal insufficiency, hypercalcemia, and recurrent infection. So, you know, you go in, you're not feeling well, they do blood work, and your calcium in your blood is like sky high, then you start investigating further. Develop bone pain and bone-related problems, so the marrow expands, the bone gets destroyed, especially in ribs, pelvis, spine, clavicle, skull, and humeri. It can lead then, you know, if you've got this imbalance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts, and you have osteoclasts dissolving bone all the time, it only makes sense that you're going to get increased amounts of calcium, right? And high levels of calcium is not good for heart rhythm. Causes lots of problems, so we don't want high levels. Bone loss and the resultant collapsing vertebra can lead to nerve root compression. And then, of course, all this hypercalcemia can all get stuck up into the kidneys and really affect the kidneys and their function, and they don't do well. Multiple myeloma is not curable, but most live 10 years post-diagnosis, which, according to the book, says that it's getting longer and longer as time goes on. Eventually, the client does relapse. Current meds have extended survival, but still incurable. Median survival is 7 years. And if you have high-risk biomarkers, maybe 3 if you're diagnosed with this. 5-year survival rate, 67% with local disease, and 52% if the disease gets distant. Vaughn, so that was sort of our cancers. Now we're going to get into clotting diseases, bleeding diseases. So Vaughn Willebrand, anybody here heard of this? Maybe yes, maybe no. I have come across it a couple times in the hospital setting, but not very, very often at all. Yeah. It is the most common inherited bleeding disorder. Affects both gender by a lack or dysfunction of something called the von Willebrand factor. Right? We don't, you know, every time I do this, I'm like, gosh, should I spend more time in the clotting mechanism when I'm in AMP1? Because it does affect here as far as that goes. Still may. So what happens is von Willebrand's is a plasma protein. It mediates the initial adhesion of platelets at sites of bleeding. It binds and stabilizes blood clotting factor 8 in the circulation. So we don't talk about clotting. I know you do. But do any of you know what happens when you clot? What has to happen when you clot? You know what it looks like when you clot, right? Okay. Well, believe it or not, there are a whole bunch of steps that have to occur to start here. I can't remember how many there are. 14? Almost 14, yeah. All the way across, and then eventually you clot. So imagine with all these steps, if you remove one of them anywhere along the line, you can't clot. Right? So this is when we talk about factors. We have these factors that influence all the steps that occur for a clot to happen. So what we're saying here is that you reduce the concentration of factor 8, and then you get poor platelet adhesion, which is required to create a clot. Von Willebrand's is a range of genetic diseases with clinical manifestations of mucocutaneous bleeding, milder than hemophilia. So you would see inside of the cheeks, under, you know, here in the eyes, rectum, urethra, those sorts of things where you see those type of tissues, you would see it. Type 1 is the most common, about 75% of people. Type 2, less common, 10 to 30%. And type 3 is the rarest and the most severe, and it's between 1 and 5%. Those who have low levels of this von Willebrand have bleeding. Those with high levels are prone to thrombosis. So you can go either way with it. You can either have an excessive amount of it, which results in spontaneous clots being created or thrombi, or you can have the other direction where you can't clot and you bleed. Symptoms can vary, depend, of course, on the subtype and severity, and many people don't even realize that they actually have it until it gets kind of recognized because it's that, it doesn't affect that much if it's at a low level. So type 1, bleeding is consistent with primary hemostasis defect. So you bruise easily, nosebleeds come and go, you have some gum bleeding, especially like when you're brushing your teeth, that kind of stuff, and or prolonged bleeding after a minor trauma. So, you know, if you know someone who has a minor cut, like a little scratch or whatever, and it just won't stop bleeding, right, then that's where you might have to think about that. Type 2 depends upon how much severity and quantity of functional VWF there is. 10 to 15% of women with menorrhagia have this condition. So women who excessively bleed during their periods may possibly actually have this disease at stage 1 or stage 2, okay, if it seems to be excessive. Type 3, more severe symptoms of above with hemarthrosis, so you get bleeding actually into the joints, and also spontaneous muscle hematomas where just under the skin you start to see these bruises appearing. Women are predisposed to having bleeding problems when menstruating. They end up with fatigue because of the amount of blood loss and also anemia. Pregnancy is a risk for these folks, especially at type 3. Treatment centers on increasing the von Willebrand chemical or factor 8. Are we producing this, Sale? Are we producing this synthetically at all? We are now, eh? Okay. Prophylactical use is used during pregnancy. Most with this condition, especially type 1, do not require treatment except if they're having something surgically done or some kind of trauma where there's a possibility of excessive bleeding that's going to occur, and then they'll deal with it. It is something that you would want to have on a card or on your wrist if you aren't able to speak for yourself if you end up in emergency, so that they're aware they may have to deal with a little more bleeding than others, even if you have type 1. Hemophilia. I don't know, does anybody read anymore? Does anybody know who some of the more famous hemophiliacs are? Yeah, do you know what royals, what family, or what country? No one reads anymore. What's that? Russian. Yes. A few of them, yes. The ones that look really odd. They have those pictures, they got the big noses and stuff. I can't remember what their families, they're still around and they're rich as rich can be, right? And I think some of that has to do with inbreeding, right? That you had, and I think one of the British royals married one of the Russians and ended up having children who had it as well. So it's still around. It is a bleeding disorder inherited as an X-linked autosomal recessive trait. In other words, this condition is passed down from parent to child. There's two primary types, hemophilia A and hemophilia B. A is due to lack of clotting factor 8, which represents 80% of cases, and B is due to the lack of clotting factor 9, about 15%. Again, remember those steps to get to clotting, right? So we're talking about where they are in the steps. These two factors are required in secondary hemostasis with von Willebrand's as the primary. So in von Willebrand's, it's just VWF that's involved. With hemophilia, it's 8 and 9, depending on which one, with a still VWF available to this individual, but their factor 8 is completely not there. These create thrombin, which cleaves the fibrinogen to fibrin, which creates the stable clot. So without them, fibrin is the precursor. Okay, fibrinogen is the precursor to fibrin. So you all have fibrinogen in you right now. It's not doing anything, it's floating around. So if you get a cut, you have to convert fibrinogen to fibrin. And it's these clotting factors that do that. So by missing it, you can't create a clot. Hemophilia A is relatively rare, where B is seen in 1 in every 30,000 males. So the gene that makes factors 8 and 9 is located on the X chromosome. So therefore, it's considered a gender-linked recessive disorder. Females normally carry 2x chromosomes that can only develop hemophilia if both are affected, whereas males only have one of the X chromosome unable to create. So remember, XY is female and XX is? XY is male and XX is female. So because of that X and Y, because females have a Y that they can work with, the passing on of the genetic alteration is a little less probable, whereas with double X, right? So double X, only if both males, because they only have one, they can't create it. Therefore, females are the carrier and males present because of this X and XY configuration. At least 10 proteins called clotting factors in the blood must work in precise order to make blood clot. And without these factors, or deficient, if they're deficient, you're unable to produce thrombin or a stable clot, so therefore you will bleed. Both A and B present with the same symptoms and can only be diagnosed through genetic testing. So from the perspective of treatment, you know, it's kind of the same. The lack of factors classifies of severity. So mild, 6 to 30% lacking, moderate, 5 to 5%, and the less severe is 1. Bruising, bleeding from the mouth or frenulum, intracranial bleeding, hematomas of the head and hemarthrosis, which is bleeding into a joint, can start to occur when early ambulation, so when just by the sheer fact of walking, the child can run into bleeding problems in the joints. And with severe form, episodes of spontaneous bleeding into joints, muscles, or internal organs, and mild to moderate do not have spontaneous bleeding, whereas the severe does. Okay. Women experience excessive uterine bleeding during menstruation, heavy flow often the symptom that initiates a coagulation evaluation. Spontaneous bleeding into the joint, one of the most common manifestations of severe, with knee being the most frequent that happens. The knee gets all filled up with blood tissue. And then, of course, elbow, hip, shoulder, and wrist. What happens is you get blood into this synovial space, and blood is irritating. It's quite acidic, actually, as compared. So it goes into the area, and then what happens then is that the synovium then reacts to absorb the blood into the synovial villi. The iron that's within the blood starts to deposit in the synovium, and what happens is that shuts down synovial fluid production. Therefore, you get more friction between bones and so forth, and it starts to destroy the joint. So you get, eventually the joints progress to advanced arthropathy, lesions and deep cartilage, subchondral bone destruction, therefore subchondral cysts, and then eventually osteophyte formation. So literally the joint just gets completely destroyed. Muscle hemorrhaging can occur often within leg muscles, the quads, psoas, and gastroc. And if you get the bleeding into this area, of course, you can end up with compartment syndromes. Have you guys done compartment syndromes in theory yet? Compartment syndromes? Have you guys done compartment syndromes in theory? So remember that your muscles are in fascial packages, right? You know, they've got the epimysium and so forth, right? And then the perimysium. So you've got, remember I said in semester one, the reason why we know one muscle versus another is because, you know, we can take them out of a package and this muscle goes to here and here in its package and then this muscle. Well, they can lie together in a much larger component or a single muscle itself in this package. What can happen is if you get bleeding in that package, the path of least resistance as blood accumulates in the package starts to squeeze down on the muscle and then eventually blood vessels and then eventually nerves and you can get like a circulation dystole and all those sorts of things. So they're not great. We don't want to get them. So because of the bleeding internally within the compartment of the muscles, we can result in what's called compartment syndrome. Treatment is based on finding deficient clotting factor and increasing its level in the blood. No known cure or prenatal treatment for this disease. Prognosis is now good, and an individual can expect to live a normal lifespan and a high quality of life. I don't remember the last time I heard of somebody who had hemophilia myself. It's been a long time. And I think probably people do. They just don't disclose because they take the medications and they don't really have much problems. Sickle cell. So sickle cell affects red blood cells, erythrocytes. It is an autosomal recessive disorder characterized by the presence of abnormal forms of hemoglobin within the erythrocytes. It is a single mutation that results in this. The presence of HbS or hemoglobin S can cause the red blood cell to change from that biconcave. Remember, red blood cells are biconcave, right? From a biconcave to a crescent or sickle shape when deoxygenated or hypoxic conditions. So literally the shape of the cell goes from that nice round donut look to sharp edges, almost like a crescent moon. Okay? And sickle cell disease, it occurs when both parents have the sickle cell gene or one sickle cell gene and another abnormal hemoglobin is inherited. One of 365,000, I don't know what double A is. Oh, thank you, right. One in 365 African Americans and one of 16,300 Hispanics is the most common inherited hematologic disorder and carries significant mortality and morbidity, especially in the first year, 3 years of life if it shows up. So very, very, when we look south of the border with a much greater population of African Americans, it's, you see it, I guess, all the time within any kind of practice. The cell resumes normal shape again after reoxygenation to return to sickle shape after deoxygenation. So when the cells are leaving the lung and they are oxygenated, they look normal. When they get out into the tissues and they give off their oxygen molecules via the hemoglobin, they take on this unusual shape. After a number of times, the cell is permanently damaged and it hemolyzes. So in other words, it dissolves and it disappears. So therefore, you get a form of anemia as a result of that. This may develop as a genetic mutation to provide protection against falciparum malaria. Are you still teaching that, Sunil?
Yes.
So the idea was that it hasn't got a cell to hang on to for malaria. Hence the reason why African-American descent due to sub-Saharan. What is malaria like in India? Is that new? Meaning like thousands of years, but like, because I think its origin was in Africa, correct? And where you live in the country, I'm assuming, as well?
Yes.
Right, certain areas, like around the Delta area, it must be really, really bad.
Yes.
Right. Oh, okay. Because you don't hear much. You always hear African, but you don't hear... Yes. Right, once you get further north, and yes. So you can see here that here's our normal hemoglobin here when oxygenated. Then once it's lost, you can see it takes on this sickle shape. You can see it here as well. And because of that, you can see how you get them sort of catching each other and getting blocked and stuck because they're unable to flow through the system appropriately because they haven't got those smooth round edges. So this sickle shell shape results in the cell adhering to the endothelium of the vessels, which then, of course, can occlude the vessel with resultant ischemia. The sickle cell on its surface has a chemical which further promotes its ability to adhere to the endothelium, which results in the cells that can't pass and they continue to accumulate, which results in occluding the vessel, which means distal to that vessel is ischemia, and ischemia is expressed by the patient as what? Pain. Ischemia is pain. So these individuals end up in eMERGE because they have these terrible, terrible pains because they have ischemic tissues distal to this and problems with it. The occlusion causes hypoxia, which causes more red blood cells to sickle, right? Remember, right? Red blood cells, when they're oxygenated in this condition, remain in a nice round way. But if you get occlusion and stasis of blood, they continue to lose their oxygen, and you just get an accumulation of more and more sickle cells. Sickle cells have a short life span compared to normal. So a sickle cell only lasts 10 to 20 days, whereas a normal red blood cell lives approximately 120 days. And because there's such a short lifespan, the ability to create new red blood cells is not fast enough to deal with the short lifespan of the sickle cell. So this individual ends up with anemia as well because they just have the lack of red blood cells. The sickle shape and resultant occlusion can start at 6 to 8 weeks of age, but normally starts at about 6 months. Ischemic pain is the most common symptom and can occur unpredictably, depending, of course, on the vessels involved, and can result in chest syndrome. So this is the inability of the sickle cell to reoxygenate in lungs. Stroke, hand-foot syndrome, so the occluded vessels that supply the metacarpal and metatarsal bones, they get affected. Do you know what priapism you guys know what priapism is? Okay, erection. They can't be returned back to normal. Because again, those cells are occluding the vessel, so the penis can get engorged with blood, but then it can't drain. Right. Through medications. But so you have a patient who would actually come to you and said, "I have had this erection now for 12 hours." And the problem is, an erection of 12 hours, if you don't deal with it, that individual will never be able to have an erection again. That's correct. Right. And it's all just about drainage. You just can't drain it. Right? So it's something that needs to be dealt with. Jaundice, of course, because you get accumulation of sickle cells in the liver and the buildup of bilirubin. And then, of course, anemia, which is a constant feature because they're always behind the eight ball in producing red blood cells to match up to those lost because it's such a short lifespan of these sickle cells as compared to normal red blood cells. Supportive care is essential for all pain crises and complications. It's my understanding as well in the U.S. now, this is one of the reasons for opioid problems, especially in the African American, because they started before they understood a whole lot about some opioids they were giving because of the amount of pain some of these individuals would get, and they would come in looking for an emergency department looking for something to relieve themselves of the pain that they're having. So I don't know, is there a direct drug that helps with this or not? I don't know if there is or not. No, just for sickle cell in general. Yes, right. Put them on straight O2 and right. So the reason that's in there, folks, is because you could possibly be dealing with someone of African American descent who is complaining of muscle pain that comes and goes, and it might be a consideration to ask the question about that in terms of if they happen to have a condition like that, because here's a possibility. It could explain some of the musculoskeletal pain they're having because they are having episodes of this occlusion that's resulting in ischemic pain. Okay, we've left blood. We are now into the lungs. Somewhere in there, yeah. Now, you left last week. I doubled one of the weeks of information, so we actually have an extra week. So week 11, 10 and 11 say the same thing. So I think we're going to be good. So respiratory system, of course, as we know, it's divided into three main portions. We have an upper airway, right, up from the larynx up. We have a lower airway, which is below, and then we get all the way out to the very ends, and we have what are known as the terminal alveoli. When we look at lung function, it's composed of ventilation, which represents the ability of air to move in and out through that pressure gradient. Remember, what's the law? Do you remember the law? Yeah. Lower container, higher pressure. Larger container, lower pressure is what law? Boyle's law. Come on, Kishan, you should have known that. So you said you were a respiratory physio. Oh, okay. So ventilation is ability to move air in and out under the pressure gradient, but respiration represents gas exchange, O2 into the blood and CO2 into the lungs. You may want to highlight that line because that's sometimes people get very confused with that. You really need to know the difference between ventilation and respiration because it represents two different areas of the system in those working parts. Hypoxemia is the most common condition caused by pulmonary disease. Hypoxemia means what? Low oxygen. That would be yes, correct. Hypoxia is low oxygen. Pathological conditions of every organ system can have secondary effects on pulmonary function and O2 pathways. Let's go back up to this pressure gradient. The pressure gradient we talk about is Boyle's law in the container getting larger and smaller compared to inside and outside. When we look at respiration, gaseous exchange of CO2 and O2 between alveoli and blood, we have to remember relies on partial pressures, right? That's why we get net movement one way or the other depending on partial pressures of gas. So anything that's going to affect the membrane between the two sides that affects the pressure differences of movement starts to affect the lungs themselves. So we have to keep all that in mind when we look at the various diseases about how it moves. Signs and symptoms of any kind of respiratory disease, cough, really common. Of course, you've got any kind of mucus or any irritant of the mucosal of this area. It is a normal reflexive reaction to try to clear it or get it out. Dyspnea, of course, which is shortness of breath. Chest pain, which is usually localized to the substernal or region over the lung fields. Cyanosis, of course, that turning blue, really represents the saturation of oxygen in the tissues, right? You have to get fairly low to get blue, but if they're blue, they're very, very, very low, right? Their saturation is very low. Clubbing, thickening and widening of the terminal phalanges, the fingers and toes, and altered breathing patterns. Changes in rate, depth, regularity, and effort can kind of represent a lung disease, but also remember that unusual breathing can also represent neurological dysfunction too, because we do have a respiratory center that controls our breathing. So anything that happens to there, like a stroke, can result in very unusual breathing patterns. So let's do pneumonia first. It's considered an acute lung injury. We have an inflammatory process that affects the parenchyma of the lungs. We can have bacterial, viral, fungal, or mycoplasmal pneumonias. And when we look at this, it's characteristics of both bacteria and viruses when it's mycoplasmal. Inhalation of toxic or caustic chemicals, smoke, dusts, or gases. And of course, anything that gets down in the lungs, such as fluids or vomitus, can also result in it. Let's go back to mycoplasmal. It's not unusual for patients to start with a viral infection, which causes a pneumonia. And then that static mucus that sits in the lungs starts to produce bacteria, and they get a secondary bacterial pneumonia on top of the viral. Primary, secondary, and often follows influenza is an inflammatory response to an invading organism or agent. You know what I should put in here? Because it's so new, COVID. As a viral, like it's, this is one of the concerns with COVID is the type of pneumonia that it created. Probably when the next edition comes out of this book, I think there'll probably be a long, large conversation with this, because I don't think people respectfully understand the damage to lung tissue that COVID, especially the initial infection that the world got, just obliterated lung tissue, just obliterated it in some individuals. So it was quite bad. New theories suggest that the cause is changes in the normal biome of the system. So it causes an overgrowth of flora that's already present in the lungs. So this is a relatively new theory that there actually is flora in the lungs that exists there. And it makes sense that there would be normal flora there. Why? It's warm and it's moist. So of course, we're breathing in things all the time. So to think that our lungs are sterile and only lung air going back and forth is... yeah, it's pretty naive, actually. The pathogen enters and macrophages are activated and they get the release of cytokines, and these send out signals for inflammatory cells to come to the site. These cytokines increase the inflammatory response, and this increases leakage of the pulmonary vessels. Let's go back to this word right here. Let's go back to COVID again. What happened in some COVID patients? A cytokine storm. It actually turned the body into it eating itself. So you get these alveoli. you'd get these cytokines released and the immune system would come in and destroy alveoli. And then you get resultant fibrosis and you start losing your ability to exchange gases. I don't know if any of you were paying attention at the time because you didn't have maybe some of this background, but it got so bad for some patients that they were doing bypass machines where they were actually taking blood out of the femoral arteries and trying to exchange gases in machines and just take the lungs right out of the picture while they were trying to heal them. Most of those folks I don't think ever made it. I think one did. I think it was a Canadian. He lost a leg. And I think he lost a hand. Yes, yes. Yes. But for how long too, right? What happens is then you get this whole thing happening, cytokines, inflammatory responses. And remember, when we have inflammation and all those chemicals with the inflammatory response, we increase the permeability of blood vessels and we get leaked fluid through those capillaries, right? The inflammation and the edema cause areas in your lung to fill up with infectious debris and exudate. So we get no gas exchange in there. How many people here have had pneumonia? You guys haven't had pneumonia ever? I remember the first time I got it, if I breathed out, I'd go, it would just stop. I'm like, huh? Because there was nothing down there. It was all fluid. And I think I got COVID before it was recognized. The Christmas before, the Christmas of 2019, I got so sick here. Still came into work. I went to a walk-in clinic and I was diagnosed with atypical pneumonia. No, that was 2019. That was the Christmas before the official outbreak. And some physicians think that some people did actually have it at the time, but they didn't know what it was. They just thought it was atypical pneumonia and away it went. Oh, I was sick. Oh, Lord, I was sick. So, types of pneumonia. Aspiration pneumonia. This is due to fluids or other material from the oral cavity or GI tract that's aspirated into the lungs. Common to the right lung and right upper lobe. Why is it more common in the right lobe? Do you remember? Yeah, the angle of the primary bronchus, right? So on the left, it has to go kind of straight across because it's got a heart to get around, whereas on the right, it drops straight down in because there's no lung in there. So anything fluid that's going to go down the trachea will tend to head off to the right more so than the left. Weirdest thing I ever saw come out of a lung was a tiny little dinky toy from a child. They aspirated a tiny, tiny little car. A car with wheels and everything. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it squeaks. Yes. Go in, grab it, pull it out. I was eating, everybody laughed. I was at work here one time and we were having lunch together and somebody told a joke and I started laughing and I was eating baked beans and I aspirated one bean. It got caught and of course I was doing the normal coughing, took a breath in and was like, huh? I aspirated it. Aspirated one bean. Now, the nice thing is one little solid bean, macrophages will come in, eat it all up, and you won't get sick from it, right? But it scared me. It was like, oh, my God, where did that bean go? I wasn't even coughing anymore. fungal pneumonia, infection by fungus, so histoplasmosis, coccidioidomycosis, and blastomycosis, and they're specific to geographical areas, right? So those sorts of things are more common to some areas than others, and it's my understanding they're quite difficult to heal, correct? To get rid of, there's a lot of medication required to get the fungus out of there because it kind of goes everywhere, right? Oh, really? Oh, okay, the body actually encases it. I once had a patient years ago, they thought he had lung cancer, and when they did a bronchoscopy, They discovered he got something from parrot feces because he had a parrot in the house. So, yeah. Right. Yeah, so I guess the feces dries, creates a powder or a dust, and he was inhaling the dust, and he got. Yeah, they actually told me he had lung cancer. He was going to die. His lungs under the, because they wouldn't have seen it here, right? They just saw the all the lesions in his lung tissue from it. So yeah, from a parrot. Viral pneumonia, of course, usually mild and self-limiting, often bilateral, can be primary or secondary. And bacterial pneumonia, destruction of respiratory epithelium by influenza can predispose the tissues to bacterial infection, often bilateral in the lower lungs. And you guys have already done your, have you guys done your auscultations yet in semester three? Have you done your lobe auscultations? So would you work, did you work like superior, middle, and lower? Zigzag? Yeah, so you're kind of. So do you go left, right, down, left, right, down, left, right? Yeah, okay. And what you're doing is you're working your way sort of through the lungs. And you'll hear, or a little bubbly, because the fluid's kind of bubbling around. Pneumonias are most are preceded by an upper respiratory infection. Signs and symptoms: a pleuritic chest pain brought on by chest movement, productive cough, which can result in a rust-colored kind of mucus, dyspnea, tachypnea, crackles, fatigue, fever, chills, and generalized myalgias. Most cases are relatively mild and resolve in anywhere to 1 to 3 weeks. And even when I got that diagnosis of atypical pneumonia, I just got sent home with some things to make me, deal with the all the other stuff, not really a whole lot for my lungs. I didn't even get a puffer, which was kind of weird. Infections that develop slowly and with a very low fever, in other words, you don't note it, is called walking pneumonia. So you're moving around, but you don't really know you have it. Treatment for bacterial and mycoplasmic forms is antibiotics, fungal types of antifungals, and viral is treated symptomatically. Now, there's a particular type of pneumonia that's related to those with a reduced immune system, very much so. Where this really showed up was the initial stages of the first pandemic of HIV. You guys know much about that? You're probably all a bit too young, aren't you? Yeah, in terms of its early years within the gay community and that kind of stuff. A movie to watch, I highly recommend if you haven't watched it or read the book. It's called End the Band Played On. End the Band Played On. It's an HBO movie, and it's all about the beginnings of the HIV epidemic. Would you call it an epidemic or pandemic? It's an epidemic, yeah. End the Band Played On. They did, because they, it's hard for us to recognize that when, because we know so much about it now, they knew nothing about it. They didn't even know the mode of transmission. They know that in, especially in North America, that there were epicenters of infection, New York City, San Francisco, and they did have very large gay populations. But they didn't even know it was a sexually transmitted disease. They didn't know if it was traveling through the air, through coughing, through touching. They had no idea at the time. And one of the things that showed up in these individuals, the reason I brought that up is because this started showing up. Pneumocystis carinii started becoming very classic to those with HIV. So you may be treating people with HIV even though you can't ask for it, but this has not gone away for those who have a very compromised immune system. So it's called Pneumocystis carinii. It's a fungal pneumonia that affects those who are immunocompromised. It's now been renamed Pneumocystis jirovecii. This fungus is now thought to be part of the pulmonary biome. So what's happened is all of us have this potential fungus in our lungs, but because we have normally functioning immune systems, we don't get ill with it. But again, those are the individuals with HIV whose system would drop, this started showing up. It is transmitted through aerosolized particles, normally affects the lungs but can spread to other organs. By the way, when we get back to aerosolized particles, I know you know, how far do you think that aerosol travels? So if I cough, there are small little droplets in my breath, and they go out. How far do they go? Any idea? What did we have to do with COVID?
6 feet.
3 to 6 feet, depending. So you have to give it time for those droplets to come out, and then they fall to the ground. Hence the reason. Some cases. Now, I once looked after a patient with, they thought he had TB, and they, at the time, they told me 3 feet. All I know is they didn't tell me until after I did the ECG, so I had no mask. I was bending over the guy doing the ECG, and he was right there. So. Pneumocystis trophozoite, we end up with these sporozoan parasites that are starting to eat, and while they do, they're attaching to the alveolar lining. It then feeds on the host cell, it enlarges and transforms into the cyst form, and that cyst ruptures and releases new trophozoites. So we have, think of, you have this one particular thing eating, and it starts to grow, and you end up with this tiny ball as it enlarges and enlarges as the trophozoites get larger, and then it bursts, and then they travel everywhere. With the release of these trophozoites, you get an inflammatory response that results in pneumonia. If the process continues, the alveoli progressively fill with organisms and proteinaceous fluid, which then results in hypoxia and then death because there's so much fluid in the lungs you can't have any gaseous exchange, right? Symptoms develop in those with HIV and present with fever, progressive dyspnea, and then a non-productive cough. So we can see here that the normal lung, that nice, dark, spacious lung, and we can see how infiltrated this lung is with all these trophozoites and fluid and so forth, that, you know, we start to really limit the square footage, shall we say, that allows for gaseous exchange. Want to take a break? Let's take a break. See you guys at 5:02. Let us continue. It's so strange for me that there's never anybody here. Like, are they like this all the time in other classes?
No.
We can't avoid it. No. No, I don't know where Caitlin is today. Do you know where Caitlin is at all? I know that Claire, she did her test yesterday because she wasn't going to be here today, but I don't know where Caitlin is. Okay. All right, pulmonary tuberculosis, formerly known as consumption. If you ever go to a movie and it's a time era and somebody's got, you know, their napkin and they got a cough and they cough in their napkin and there's blood, at the time was probably respiratory or pulmonary tuberculosis. It's infectious. An inflammatory systemic disease, it affects the lungs, and can move to involve other organs. It is caused by Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which results in granulomas, caseous cheese-like necrosis, and subsequent cavity formation, so large cavities because of the breakdown of tissue. Spread through droplets in the air, can be eradicated through normal immune defenses, cause a primary TB infection, or get walled off by the body's immune system, which results in a latent infection. Primary or secondary, with first primary infection, usually is asymptomatic and remains quiet but develops hypersensitivity to the microorganism. It's because of this, if you've ever had a TB test, you may show that you're positive, which means you've been exposed to this, but it didn't move into a disease state. Primary usually involves middle or lower area of the lung with lesions of exudation, and secondary develops of either endogenous from within or exogenous external reinfection, and usually in upper lobes of one or both lungs. So, you know, if you come around it a second time, it does increase your probability of catching the disease once you get it. So you can see it here. You've got this, you've got a bit of it, it sits in here. You see this at the top, and then you get where it starts digging a bit of a hole into the lung, and you get what's called this gaseous look, where you start getting the infection traveling through, and all these small little cavities, and then very, very large cavities start occurring in the lungs, which you can see here in the x-ray, that there actually is a hole a bit in the lung here. Now, you can get it from inhaling droplets or a sneeze, and initially, again, it creates this granuloma, which then progresses on to destroying the lung tissue. It still remains a global health problem, with 30 high-risk countries, most cases still being in India, China, Indonesia, Philippines, Pakistan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, and South Africa. And that was the last time the book was published, which was about a year and a half ago. I don't think there's been many changes to it, but I think those are still the major companies. Multi-drug resistance is emerging as a major global infectious disease. And I put in here, take your full prescription. This is the problem with most people. When they get a prescription, when they get feeling better, they stop taking it, which leads to drug resistance. If we get into a tuberculosis drug-resistant strain, we're in big trouble because it's going to spread everywhere. Yes. Well, didn't India just have a massive outbreak about 2 years ago, like a significant outbreak of tuberculosis? Or was that... Okay. Right. No, I think it was polio. I think India had a major polio outbreak, didn't it, a couple years ago? No? Oh, I thought that. Okay. Certain segments of the population have an increased risk, and of course we're looking at immune system. Those with HIV, 65 years or older, immunocompromised, IV drug users, and alcohol dependency, economically disadvantaged, in other words, living in poor environment, children under 5, prison inmates simply because of their close exposure to each other, family and friends of those infected, and end-stage renal disease. These are the folks who have the highest risk in terms of it. Causative agent is the tubercular bacillus, which is you end up inhalating the infected airborne particle known as a droplet nuclei, and then it's produced by the infected person who's coughing, laughing, or singing, etc. What's interesting is when you read this now, coughing, laughing, or singing, it's exactly what happened with COVID, right? People were coughing, laughing, singing. Remember when the one choir that got it really badly, right, the one time? Casual contact or brief exposure will not result in infection. You need a longer duration and closer proximity to contribute to the transmission. There are three primary stages: primary infection, latent infection, and active disease. So the person inhales the droplet nuclei, and you end up with this bacilli ingesting by the macrophages because they've ended up in the lung tissue. They're not killed by the macrophage, though, unfortunately. The bacilli actually starts to reproduce within the macrophage who's ingested it. Epithelial cells surround and encapsulate the multiplying bacilli to wall it off, which results in a granuloma that can have a necrotic center and look caseous, like curdled cheese. So it'll actually get a bit of a hole in the center and get this curdled look. Bacilli then can move into the circulatory system and lodge in any organ, obviously lymph for sure because of the relationship, spine and weight-bearing joints, urogenital system, and the meninges themselves. People always forget about spinal tuberculosis because they don't see it much anymore, but it used to be very, very, very common. 2 to 10 weeks post-initial infection, we get a cell-mediated immunity, which usually limits further multiplication and spread of the bacteria. And then once that bacilli are walled off, they're not necessarily destroyed, they're just walled off. Now, normal immune system individuals generally don't see it on radiography. It's usually the skin test or the blood test that shows that you actually have it. Now, I don't know if it's changed, but I one time had a TB test. It came back positive, so I had to go for an x-ray to see if there was any kind of granuloma in there, and I didn't have one. So, of course, I had somehow contacted it, but it hadn't progressed to any kind of disease state. If infection not controlled by immunity, the symptoms develop, known as active TB, which can also be the result of reinfection. So the idea is that you may not get symptoms in your first infection, but if you get another infection, it starts to increase the risk of it becoming active tuberculosis. So signs and symptoms of this active TB: productive cough for 3 weeks or more, unexplained weight loss, night sweats, fever, fatigue, chest pain, and adventitious breathing with crackles and wheezes. It can develop solely outside of the lungs to other areas, lymph nodes, pleura, genital urinary system, GI tract, bones, and central nervous system. So it can go there. Funny, I thought I put a picture in here of a vertebral body, but when you look back here, that it actually, through the granuloma, produces these big whole spaces here. Same thing happens in the vertebral body. If tuberculosis gets in there, it actually eats away the vertebral body. You get this big hole, and then the body just goes, just crushes down. COPD. Talked about it a little bit previously. So it is a common, preventable, and treatable disease characterized by persistent respiratory symptoms and airflow limitation that is due to airway and/or alveolar abnormalities, usually caused by significant exposure to noxious particles or gases. Of course, number one would be smoking, right? It's the third leading cause of death in the U.S., almost always caused by exposure to environmental irritants, especially smoking, which is the most common cause. There is a genetic predisposition form and possibly other genes, but here's the weird thing about lungs. My mother is 90 years old. She has smoked a pack of cigarettes since she was 15, and she doesn't have this. Right? There's other precipitating factors, your own genetics and so forth, right? But I do, if you remember in semester one, always ask if students are smoking, because you are going to have some form of lung disease if you smoke. I don't think my mom's lungs are great, but she doesn't seem to have progressed to this. It is strongly associated with age, presents 55 to 60. It is equal in genders because of these changing smoking habits. I mean, back in the 50s, 60s, men mostly smoked, women not so much, so we saw this great increase in heart disease and lung diseases and so forth. But now, I don't know about you guys, I see this anecdotally, I think there's more girls now smoking than boys. I go to parties or socially I'm out, or even here at the college, it's the girls that are out smoking cigarettes, right? The other thing that's not in here, and I know it's going to come, is vaping. I truly believe that vaping is going to, in years to come, the research is going to show, I think it's probably going to be worse than smoking. Because you are, again, you're putting noxious particles into your lungs. And what I was always taught was it is the super heat at that burning end that causes the chemical changes that results in all the carcinogens and so forth, toxins that are produced when you smoke a cigarette. So if you've got an element that's superheating, of course you're going to have problems. But I think there's also more particulate in vape than there is in tobacco smoke, I believe. I could be wrong, but I just know when I see people do a vape and they exhale out, the amount of stuff that comes out of them compared to when they have a cigarette, it's like, oh my goodness, it's just crazy. Air pollution is also a potential risk factor. Would make sense. Exits abnormal chronic. What happens is you get abnormal chronic inflammatory cycle that results in structural changes to the airways and vasculature. So you get an airway obstruction, so hard to get air in. Then when the air gets in there, it gets trapped. It can't get out. There's changes to the walls of the and the basal membrane between the capillaries and the alveoli. You get excessive mucus secretion because of inflammation. You get static and dynamic hyperinflation, so the lungs become too full because of this trapping, which results in pulmonary hypertension, exercise intolerance, and systemic features because we're not getting exchange. So it's pretty classic. What you get is a protease, anti-protease imbalance, which means that you don't get the amount of elastin in the lungs, so they don't have the elastic flexibility to return back. So there's no compliance for the lungs to get back small again. They get stuck outward. This results in cell changes, which reduces expiratory flow with gas trapping, which then results in static and dynamic hyperinflation. So what you get is narrowing airway that prevents full emptying. So you get increased functional residual capacity. So this individual is able to take a big breath in and then go, and that's all they can get out. So you have all those problems with that. The trapped air causes decrements in inhalation volume and decreases in respiratory muscle function. In other words, it decreases the volume of air that can enter the lungs. You get it worsened with elevations in rate. So they start breathing faster, which again, it's like sort of stagely, through stages, filling up a container more and more. Hyperinflation changes the length-tension relationship and contractile properties of the musculature. So you can't even get enough tension created to breathe out. Gas exchange is affected by structural changes in the alveoli, poor ventilation, and retention of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is acidic, which results in an increased possibility of acidosis, right, which is deadly at the best. Common signs, dyspnea, air hunger, sputum production, excessive amounts at the end, activity intolerance, and a chronic cough. Because of this air hunger and because of this hyperinflation with this increase of rate, you get raised shoulders and muscles tensed from increased shortness of breath and WOB, work of breathing. So SCMs, intercostals, serratus posterior superior and inferior, quadratus lumborum, all the muscles that are involved in moving them, the intercostals, they just get a mess because they're working so much. I can't remember what this is, to be honest. Oh, yes. Can you turn this off for a moment? You saw his shoulders are very thin and very upwards. You noted that even to have a conversation between words, he was having to take a big breath in just to carry enough air to be able to carry a few words in a conversation. The color of his skin was very kind of gray, but red around the nose and the cheeks. It's relatively common. So, you know, it's how did I end up back here? Right, I was talking about that. So, you know, it's a good it's a good video because it does give you a sense of what someone looks like. So, chronic bronchitis is our first sort of form of COPD. Clinically defined as a condition of productive cough lasting for at least three months, usually in the winter, per year for two consecutive years. Can exist alone or with chronic airway obstruction, and chronic bronchitis increases the risk for developing COPD. What you get is inflammation and scarring of the bronchial lining. And what can happen is this inflammation can obstruct airflow to and from the lungs, and it increases mucus production, which, of course, will then further narrow the airway to allow air in and out. Cigarette smoking, long-term dust inhalation or air pollution cause mucus hypersecretion and hypertrophy of the mucus-producing glands in the large bronchi. So therefore, we get this huge amount of mucus, and we get these mucus-producing glands getting further enlarged to even produce more. So you end up with these swollen mucus membranes and thick sputum that obstruct the airways. This results in wheezing and cough, impaired ciliary function because the amount of mucus, the cilia can't even function properly to move it on, and therefore you can't clear mucus, which increases infection, the probability because it's statically sitting there, and you get thickening of the bronchial wall. All of it results in shortness of breath, prolonged expiration, persistent coughing with expectoration, and recurrent infections. If it develops into COPD, it results in reduced chest expansion, wheezing, cyanosis, and decreased exercise intolerance. What can happen is this obstruction decreases alveolar ventilation and increase a partial pressure of CO2 in blood. So therefore, you're not going to get a net movement of it, and it's going to hang around. This is the problem with trapped air and acidosis. If the patient can't blow off CO2, then the environment becomes more and more acidic. And I think I mentioned this when I talked in first semester, is that if they're in a bit of crisis, a respiratory therapist will go and take what's called a blood gas, and they'll take a sample of arterial blood, not venous blood, and they go right into here, and it's not comfortable. And because it's an artery, they actually have to keep pressure on it because it's an artery under pressure. It's a small needle, but it does, my understanding is it doesn't feel very comfortable for the patient. But they take the arterial blood, they put it in a machine, and they get a sense of how the pH is. And if the pH is heading down in the acidic direction, then they're in what's called acidosis, and that doesn't take very low. Don't have to get too acidic before the patient is in significant crisis, and they can die. So they have to deal with it accordingly by helping the lungs vent off more CO2. So would you give them more oxygen? Yeah, right. So, but would you give them fresh oxygen to help them? Why not? Yeah, because they'll trap even more, and then you run into a problem, right? So we do things like CPAP occasionally, but more so ventilation. So you saw the gentleman puffing on that teepee. So Ventolin gets used, and if it's really bad, if you have one. But the what's it called when it's like? When it's like steamy like that, it's Ventolin, but it's but what's there's a name we use when they do it. Oscar, it'll bug me. But yeah, it's a nice moist. There's a bit of Ventolin in it, and it's steam, and it just nebulizer. Thank you, and it helps clear out that mucus and break the airways up a little bit to get it out. But ultimately, what happens is the chest gets so big they can't breathe in anymore, and they suffocate to death. It's a terrible way to go. This can lead to hypoxemia, so a below-level oxygen in the blood, then to polycythemia, which is a high concentration of red blood cells, and cyanosis. Because you have to remember, at the blood level, if we're low on oxygen chronically, the body will start to overproduce red blood cells to try to carry more oxygen. If it's not reversed, you end up in what's called pulmonary hypertension, which can lead to then cor pulmonale, which has the right side of the heart failing because the pressure is backing up out of the lungs, and the only direction it goes, of course, is back to where the blood came from, which is the heart itself. So we can see here, we've got the inflammation that's occurring here, this excess mucus. We start to see a real narrowing of the airway plus mucus. It just gets smaller and smaller. The smooth muscle, the middle wall, the tunica media, bronchioles here. The muscular wall gets thicker, which again narrows it in, and then you get this inflammatory tissue and so on. So you just narrows right down into a thin area here, hence the reason for the wheeze. The second type of COPD is emphysema. This is an enlargement of air spaces beyond the terminal bronchioles and associated with loss of elasticity in the lung tissue. Airways themselves, the airway collapses, and then you end up trapping gas. There are three types of emphysema. There's a central lobular, which is the most common, so you get destruction of the bronchioles in the upper lung. Inflammation can occur in the bronchioles, but usually it's more with the alveolar sac remaining intact. This is the most common type of emphysema in smokers. Then you get panlobular emphysema. It destroys air spaces. If the acinus, airspace is in the acinus, and the most commonly of the lower lung type is the span lobar, so up here, sort of getting higher, and then the periseptal, pansonar, which destroys the alveoli in the lower lobes, resulting in isolated blebs, which are small collections of air between the lung and the outer surface of the lung. So you actually get an airspace between the lung and the pleural cavity, and you get collection of air in there. And then you end up with a reduction of lung size and so forth. Usually in chronic smokers, you get this with central lobular along with the central lobular and then the periseptal. So you can see here, with the normal, we can see it coming all the way down. We have these lovely little grapes, I call them, with increased surface area for gaseous exchange. Here is a bleb here within the lung itself where you start getting it broken down. So you can see here we have lots of surface area here and all these intact alveoli. And then with emphysema, you can see they start collapsing and then they start popping just like the little bubbles in bubble wrap. And then what you're, all you're doing here is you're just decreasing surface area for exchange more and more and more. And so again, normal here, emphysema here just doesn't function well. So as you destroy more and more lung tissue, of course you get physical and blood adaptations, which lead to its own problems. Cigarette smoking is the major etiological factor in the development of emphysema. It increases the number of macrophages and neutrophils in the lung. The best I've ever heard is that smoking causes chronic inflammation. Your lungs never are not inflamed if you continue smoking. They're always inflamed because of the irritant of the smoke. Other factors must be involved because it's less than 10 to 15% of people who smoke actually develop any evidence of airway obstruction. So there's other mechanisms in play that we're not sure of. As I said, my mom's 90 and she's still not doing too bad. Emphysema occurs as a result of prolonged respiratory difficulties, such as chronic bronchitis that has caused partial obstruction of the smaller airways. Inhaled particles induce inflammation and damage the airways, which increases the compliance of the airways. When we talk about compliance of airways, we're basically saying how easily air can travel along the airway. Chronic inflammation, airway trapping, and chronic sputum production. Destruction of the elastin in the lung that was that normally maintains the strength of the alveolar walls equals this permanent enlargement of the acini and therefore the surface area of gaseous exchange occurs. I can tell you that when treatment is given to some of these individuals, the amount of mucus that comes out of their lungs is actually quite disgusting. You can have like a copious amount when you have that done. All this stuff just comes out. It's quite extensive and not nice looking. Loss of elasticity causes narrowing or collapse of the bronchioles, which traps air in the lungs. The alveoli lose their connections to each other, which results in further air trapping. And then that air trapping is worsened with increased inhalations, which results in inhalation before full expiration. So normally, what goes in equals what goes out. In these folks, what goes in and what goes out is unequal. So you get more in, less out, and then they take another breath, further fills, less out. Another breath, it just keeps stacking until the lungs become completely hyperventilated. So you've got this dynamic hyperinflation. Obstruction results from changes in lung tissue rather than mucus production. At the end, permanent overdistension between the alveoli is accompanied with partial airway collapse and loss of elastic recoil. And then because of all this, you get abnormalities in vasculature. So you get increased smooth muscle in the intima, and which makes it even harder to do gaseous exchange. The work to breathe is increased because of this hypoxemia and hypercapnia. You get an increased effort in exhalation with no recoil and flattening of the diaphragm caused by hyperinflammation. So you're not able to breathe out. They try hard to breathe out. So I was saying to Sunil that when I saw my father-in-law, he puffed. So one of the things you'll see with emphysema is they puff, because what they're doing is they're trying to increase pressure to force out. That's their way of trying to force out. Pulmonary hypertension again develops, leading to core pulmonary right heart failure. So initially, the symptoms may only be apparent during physical exertion, but eventually leads to dyspnea at rest, which due to this irreversible destruction of the elasticity of the lung. Cough is uncommon with little sputum and emphysema. Often thin, tachypnea, with prolonged expiration, and must use secondary muscles for inflammation, for ventilation. Like I said, their SCMs, their scalenes, and so forth are all just rock hard. Common position of patient to increase lung capacity, they tend to sit with forward flexion, arms braced on the knees, supporting the shoulders and the chest. It's the way they attempt to try to open their lungs up. The trapped air and alveolar distension leads to change of size and shape of the chest, which results in a barrel chest and increased expiratory effort. I remember my very first lady, I had to do an ECG on, and she had end-stage emphysema. And it shocked me because where normally a female's breasts tend to be forward, her breasts were actually out here on the sides because she had expanded her chest wall physically so much at the end of this that her breast tissue actually faced outwards this way because the anterior wall of her chest had come forward so much to try to expand that chest out. Nocturnal hypoxemia can manifest. So during sleep, there's a decrease in the sensitivity of chemoreceptors, decreased firing of intercostals, and increased airway resistance. So they really get low oxygen at night when they're sleeping. And if they have obstructive sleep apnea on top of that, they get in terrible, terrible shape. Asthma. Should I do asthma or should I finish? How many slides are left in this? There's quite a few, isn't there? There's a lot. Let's finish it there, and we'll start asthma next week.
Okay, thank you.